Welcome to the ICRL podcast. Today we have a special treat, a very special friend who needs no introduction to those of you who are familiar with the PEAR program. Roger Nelson, who was a member of the PEAR staff for many, many years, and in more recent years has been directing a fascinating program called the Global Consciousness Project. We're going to ask Roger to tell us a bit about the Global Consciousness Project. We want to welcome him sincerely and warmly. So glad to have you with us today, Roger.
Thank you, Brenda. It's nice to be here and to have a chance to talk about the Global Consciousness Project, one of my favorite things. It stems out of the PEAR Lab, as probably anybody familiar with the PEAR Lab knows. We use the same technology exactly as that developed in the PEAR Lab, both for hardware and for the statistical analysis. And so it's a kind of, I guess one could say, extension of or an extrapolation from what we did at the PEAR Lab.
You might want to, for those people who are not familiar with the field reg experiments that we did at PEAR, which were really the forerunners of the GCP, maybe you could talk a little bit about that ancient history and what stimulated you to get into this.
Right. The field reg was itself a kind of double entendre. We went out into the field with the idea that using the same technology, random number generators, that we used in the lab to study the effect of intention on physical systems, that we could use those same random number generators to find out if something like a group consciousness might change the way these devices behave. So it was a bit of a stretch in a certain sense, but we thought maybe consciousness isn't confined to the head or not even to the very local domain right around the person. But instead, we think it's possible that the effects of human consciousness that we find in these experiments might be transmitted by way of a field, and that it might affect random number generators, both in situations where people are intentionally trying to change the behavior and in other situations like a group focusing on a ritual or maybe something beautiful like a ceremony in the woods or a fantastic concert of some sort.
Well, you'll recall that one of the descriptions that we got very often at PEAR from people who were successful with their results, their investigations, was they would talk about something akin to resonance. You know, being on the same wavelength with the machine, being in tune, being in synchrony. And of course, we also found that, you know, in our co-operator experiments, that people who were resonant with each other were producing bigger effects as well. So there's something about that whole phenomenon of resonance that may generate some kind of a field or information field. What is the expression from the song, you know, whenever two or more of you are gathered in my name, something happens.
I always thought that effect of two people working together, which was so much stronger than those people working alone, must be because they're practiced at they're bonded pairs. They're the ones who had the big effects. They're practiced at the resonance. They know how to do that. And so they can extend that rather easily to the machine, bring the machine in to make a triad?
Well, you know, it was not that difficult to look at intention in the laboratory. Because you could say, oh, I intend to go high or I intend to go low. But looking at resonance in the laboratory is another matter. Mm-hmm. You can't say, okay, now you love it, now you don't. Now you love it, now you don't.
No, quite so. So the field reg experiment was really a way of capitalizing on the fact that people do become resonant without trying or without being instructed to do so. When they're listening to great music that everybody loves, or when they're, and I think this is one of the most powerful sources of that kind of interpersonal resonance, rituals forever, for thousands and eons of time, we human beings have created rituals so that we could come together and resonate with each other and accomplish things that were, in the old days, we thought magical, and presently I think we should also see those as magical. I always loved the field rig experiments because they were a kind of a mechanism or means to see something about human consciousness which is otherwise just not visible. This resonance that we're talking about, who can measure that? Who knows how to measure that? But the field reg experiments, I think, were a good step in the direction of being able to measure something extremely subtle but very important about the way humans interact with each other.
Yes, so many people have had the experience, even though they can't describe it. I know I have on many, many occasions where you're having some experience, like you say, listening to music, watching a great play, being at some kind of ritual or, you know, whatever it may be, and you feel something. You just feel that everybody is suddenly click. You know, we feel it when we meet people too. So you meet a new person and you have a sense of connection, and other people you meet and you go, eh. So this is something that's part of our lives, and it's something that we don't think about or talk about or learn about very often, and yet it's there, and as you say, it's been there since the beginning of human activity and culture. And I think it's just great that we're able to come up with a way that we could actually measure, if you want to use the term measure in a loose sense.
Well, it's a little surprising to me that only the poets, really, and people who write songs have been able to deal with it. Science just hasn't found it possible, I guess, until very lately. And I think it's very much in our field. People like you and Bob and others and associated with the, you know, the Pear Lab, but in a little bit wider field. There's a few people that are trying to look at consciousness as it exists in the world. And it's not the neurophysiology that we're thinking about, but the presence of mind.
Well, that's because scientists don't usually go to rock concerts.
Or if they do, they think they're just listening to the music.
Right.
And they don't think it's going to affect them. But it does. We actually know from certain kinds of, well, personal experience is really clear. If you, if the music really comes together, most of us, I think, get a little physiological frisson, or whatever that word is. You know, it's like something I hugely appreciate. It just, it marks the moment in such a strong way. And those moments are also seen by our random number generator.
What prompted you to move beyond these ritualistic or whatever one might call them venues to this much broader view that GCP is doing? How did you get onto that track?
Well, implicit in the stepwise movement from the lab to the field with a single instrument in both cases is asking, what if you have two instruments? What if you have 20? And what about distance? Does it matter if the instrument is in the room or in the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid? So to answer those questions, I thought, well, I did a few pilot kinds of experiments or prototypes. I asked people all over the, well, everybody I knew who used random number generators for experiments to take data during certain kinds of events, like the one that most people know about is Princess Diana's funeral. So I had 12 different random number generators in the U.S. and Europe running. People sent me the data, integrated it, and sure enough, there was a big deviation, about 1 in 100 likelihood that it was just chance fluctuation. During that period of 6 hours that was the worldwide global event of Diana's funeral,
So the idea was that there were thousands or maybe millions of people who were sharing that experience mm-hmm. on a deep emotional level.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. I think the Diana event was exactly a prototype in that sense too, because you hit the key to these kinds of experiments, at least the global consciousness ones, emotion. Mm. If we're not just resonant, but emotionally resonant, there's something very powerful that comes out of that.
I think they used to call it love.
And I think that may be the answer to the problems of the world, if we could get everybody to just recognize that it feels good, makes you healthier, to extend love and compassion. You know, it's like mm-hmm. Such an easy... And those things, by the way, when we have now 450 events
wow.
of different kinds, some of them are big, some are small, they almost all have really at their core of definition, or the reason we chose them, was that they did have the capacity to move people, lots of people, emotionally in the same way. So we can sort through those and say, how much compassion is represented in event number 1 and 2 and 3 and so forth? In other words, rate them with regard to something we think may be important to the business of global consciousness or any kind of extended consciousness.
Although you're talking about, you know, the positive, the things that draw people together in a positive way, probably the event that the GCP is most well known for was the period during the 9/11, mm-hmm. the fall of the Twin Towers. Mm-hmm. And that was certainly a deeply emotional event, mm-hmm. but it was not something that was a happy one. But it did draw people together.
Yeah. I've thought about it quite a bit, as I think most everyone knows about, which is almost everybody, has. And that it lasted such a long time in our consciousness space. And in fact, in the GCP data, the major changes in the primary measure we use lasted for more than 2 days. It's like 2.5 days. So during that period of time, our emotions changed. At first, there was something like fear or anxiety, what's going on? And then there was the recognition of a great tragedy. And then somewhere in the mixed in there would be some anger. Ultimately, I think these were all mixed together, but in all cases, they were probably shared by millions and millions of people.
And, of course, compassion.
And, yes, there was a great deal of compassion. And not just for the people who were killed. It was a compassion, on the part of vast numbers of people around the world for our culture, for society. This was, like many of those kinds of events, a shredding of the social contract. You know, this is not something you do. Take over airplanes, turn them into bombs, and then kill as many people as you can with them. That's not the way humans are supposed to be.
But the results that you got on your various random event generators that were running during that time showed a coherence across these different devices that was well beyond what you'd expect by just chance. Mm-hmm. Outputs of a bunch of random number generators.
Right. We had, I think, something like 35 or 38 or so devices running then. They were pretty much spread around the world. We had one in Fiji, a couple in Australia, several in Europe, and several in the U.S. And what we have learned by looking more carefully or closely at the analysis is that that number that we produce in the fundamental analysis is really representing a correlation between these devices, even though they're designed to be completely random and completely independent, and they're now thousands of miles separated from each other. So they become correlated in the presence of this, what we think of as a kind of consciousness field, where large numbers mm-hmm. of people are sharing emotions like compassion.
The results that we've seen at PAIR and elsewhere, as well as in the GCP in the random event generator data, seem to indicate that what is ostensibly or originally a random process, that is a bunch of random bits of ones and zeros just thrown together, seem to exhibit more order, shall mm-hmm. we say.
Yeah.
That somehow they're not quite as random. The randomness or the entropy is reduced. Is that what you've seen in your other events as well?
In a word, yes. The analysis is a little bit different in that what we're looking at is correlation between, literally pairwise correlation. We take A and B, and then A and C, and A and D, and so forth, do all those pairs and ask, is there correlation? In the case of the individual, single REG in an intention experiment, we're just asking, is the mean shifted?
Right.
So in the one case, we're asking, is the mean of the output of the random number generator shifted and to the high, to the low direction, or not? And in the other case, we're asking, is this correlation positive? And it could be positive if they both went in the low direction, just as it would be a positive correlation if they both went in the other direction. So it's a little different, but ultimately I think we're seeing the same kind of thing. The randomness is decreased ever so slightly. A little bit of structure is introduced into a sequence that is fundamentally random and unpredictable.
It almost sounds like if you have these going in an environment, whether it's a physical environment or a consciousness environment, when people are all on the same wavelength, that synchrony, that resonance among all these minds and consciousnesses might be creating as you said before, a field that's an organizational field. A field introduces order in some fashion into random processes. And, you know, it could be almost any random process. How do you know? What makes you... Why the devices you have...
Oh, dear.
You've heard this question before, hundreds of times, I'm sure. But what do you think determines a particular REG that I have sitting here on my desk, running willy-nilly, you know, all the time with me paying any attention to it, and then there's some kind of a tragedy or some kind of celebration? Why should my random event generator care?
Right.
Is it because I care? Does it matter if I care or not?
Well, I think this is such an interesting area because you're talking in some sense about what some people refer to as an experimenter effect and experimenter psi effect, where the experiment comes out the way the experimenter wants. And I think there's something to that, but unfortunately people tend to go whole hog and they find sort of a recipe, then they want to apply that recipe to everything.
But who's the experimenter? If you've got 75
yes,
of these boxes,
right.
You've got 75 experimenters.
And for all we know, there may be maybe 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 people who know about this sort of thing. They say, oh, then the GCP people are going to be asking, what about mm-hmm. this? So I think it's a very complex kind of system, and we, the experimenters, are part of it. We really are. We have to be. We couldn't even be doing the experiment unless we're there.
I mean, the experimenter is the one that's asking the question.
Yeah, and I think we necessarily should include all the people in a laboratory experiment as the so-called participant or operator or subject, depending on which laboratory. Mm-hmm. And then there's the machine. You know, mm-hmm. in these experiments, it's not a non-entity. It's really there, and it's part of the system. And so we have to acknowledge something, give it a name like consciousness, in the machine as well as in the...
Sure.
I don't know about motion. Does my random number generator care?
There are days when I know my random event generator is out to get me.
Oh,
other
yes.
days when it seems very friendly. But you know, you really can't exclude anything, can you?
No, I don't think so.
It's not just the experimenter, it's not just the machine, it's the participant, the operator, it's the experimenter, you will recall how many times we noticed this at PAIR, the dynamic among the staff.
Exactly.
When we were all on, the operators tended to do better. The environment itself, and the broader environment, the academic environment, you can't really exclude anything from that analysis, can you?
No, you can't. I think when we start talking about subtle things about mind and consciousness, we quickly run up against the fact that it's not an isolated, localized process. There's not some single force that's moving things. Instead, it's a wonderful kind of appreciation of, in modern terms, of what the ancients always said. There isn't any such thing as a separation.
Right.
And there is a kind of oneness of mind, of matter. The universe is just one thing. And the ideas of entanglement, an electron or a particle pair, when separated, are still entangled even over astronomical distances. That wouldn't be a big surprise to the people who wrote the Vedas.
To the contrary, I think they'd be amazed that we would think there would be a separation.
Right.
it's the way our culture tends to look at the world, isn't it? As separate pieces, instead of as the integration of many different parts into a single whole. It's part of our medical situation as well.
You know, I think the answer to why this happens is that it's easy. It's easy to look at one little thing. It's not so easy to look at the interactions of that thing with all its neighbors and the universe around it. But it's necessary. I think one of the reasons that so many problems are so frustrating in science and medicine is that people try to take it apart and look at the small bits and then somehow imagine they can get a full understanding by putting those bits of understanding back together.
It's bizarre, isn't it? You know, if you look at something like a drop of water, which is made up of hydrogen and oxygen. If you looked at hydrogen separately and you looked at oxygen separately, I don't think you'd ever come up with the idea of water.
No. And you know what? It goes even further. And if you have the hydrogen and oxygen properly related in their H2O-ness, and you don't have a covalent bond linking this one to another molecule like that, then you're going to... It's not water.
Exactly. You go from a drop to a flow to a river to an ocean, you know.
The flexibility of that bond is what makes flow. And maybe that's a metaphor for what goes on between the human operator and the REG in the lab. There's a kind of bond, a covalent, flexible bond that might not exist without the context of the experiment, the experimenter, and all that stuff.
So in a sense, the results of the Global Consciousness Network are almost like a whole bunch of drops coming together to create a larger flow that may appear to be independent parts, but they're really just different components of the same oneness. And that oneness is somehow related to the consciousness of... Well, we're looking at humans, I guess. There's no reason why it should stop there.
I think not. Although we don't know any good ways to find out what the trees are thinking.
as if the question wasn't complicated enough.
But I think we can acknowledge that the system certainly includes animals. Although we do have one little analysis that interestingly says... If you have major earthquakes, the kind that do damage and knock buildings down and kill people, Richter magnitude 6 and greater, you know, assemble all those over many years and look at the global consciousness data, there's two categories. Either it's on land where it can do damage, or it's not. It's in the ocean. So there is structure in the ones on land. It's pretty striking that over, I think there's something like 600 altogether, 100 of them are on land, and in the one analysis we did, has a very sharp pattern right around the time of the earthquake, starts before, ends after, but not in the ocean. In the ocean, even though the fish and the whales and so forth might notice something, they don't care.
So if an earthquake happens in the ocean and nobody hears it?
That's right.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. It's one of the many things that I think really helped to solidify the notion that it is consciousness, and it's human consciousness, in fact, in the Global Consciousness Project, that matters. Our random number generators don't do much of anything unusual, unless there's some gathering point for a large amount of human consciousness. 98% of the data and more is in periods that where we have not identified events. Doesn't mean nothing happened, but there's nothing that we've timed and analyzed. So that looks like totally random data, 98% of it.
When you look at all of these random event generators all over the world and there's no event being identified, do you see correlations? Are they talking to each other?
They might be, but not so that we can see it. The correlations even during the events are pretty subtle and small, and it takes a lot of patience to see them statistically. But in the standard data, if we just do analysis of the whole database, asking this question, is there any correlation between the devices? The answer is basically no. If there is, it's much too small to see in the 15 years of data that we have.
Mm. Let me, just to clarify this for myself and perhaps for our listeners as well, you have a human consciousness, a human mind that defines an event, whether it be a funeral, a birth, a tragedy, a celebration, whatever. And in the definition of that event, whether everybody else in the group is aware of that or not, somehow or other there's a coherence that begins to emerge on a very subtle, small level. Mm-hmm. That's mind-blowing.
Well, there's, you know, if I've extended what you're saying just a little bit, one could say the mind that is doing the definition is all there is, and that mind is reaching out across the thousands of miles and changing the behavior in a correlated fashion of all these devices. Since that's me, I have a feeling it's wrong, and that idea wouldn't work.
My impression was that you have a lot of people defining events.
There are quite a number. There are probably about 24 people who only half a dozen who regularly send me things. But
have you ever looked at those events? Do you find that certain people are producing results and others not? Or is there enough data for that?
There is enough data for that, at least for the comparison of Roger Nelson versus everybody else. And Roger Nelson has a slightly larger success rate, but it's not significantly different from everybody
else.
But
he also has a larger database.
Yes, exactly. I think, if I understand what you mean, much more experience.
Yeah. When you're doing statistics, the number of events you're looking at has a lot to do with it. But if you have somebody else who has made, let's say, a dozen predictions, and you look at theirs, do you find the same sort of pattern? Do they have as much success as Roger Nelson does or Joe Blow?
Yeah, there's at least one guy who is, I guess you might say, 100% on. I'm maybe 60 or 70%, but he's only given me predictions for maybe 4 or 5 events.
But you didn't know what he was defining, so it couldn't be you.
That's correct, I didn't know.
Well, of course, after the fact, you look at, and we all know not only is this stuff spatially independent, it's time and energy.
The people who want observational theories to work don't care about time or any of that, so feedback from the future is just as good as any other feedback.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think you know, from, there was another track where we could go from, rather than toward the experimenter, toward the group or global consciousness. I think that we were talking before about how people can become resonant. You know, you fall in love, you become resonant. So you start to hear the same songs the same way. That happens to people, either in emergency circumstances or because of fear or compassion, but also in celebratory moments like New Year's, for example. There are just a zillion people around the world who are waiting for midnight to happen.
At different times.
At different time zones, but we can take care of that statistically by stacking the time zones and making an average across them. But these people, I am, and I think probably everybody listening who celebrates New Year's at all will be waiting for midnight and won't think about it much until a couple minutes before, and somebody will say, oh, it's almost midnight. So everybody goes searching for their boyfriend or girlfriend and a glass to toast or whatever. And then there's a kind of countdown and bam, at midnight. So we make a prediction.
But everybody is singing Auld Lang Syne, and I understand they do that in many different countries.
Even though Auld Lang Syne might not be your favorite song, nevertheless, it brings people together, or people do it because they are together. Mm. And our data do it kind of nicely in synchrony with the people. We make two predictions. One has to do with the mean shift. One has to do with the breadth or width of the distribution. We say people are coming together. We'll predict that this variability will decrease around midnight, and we get a lovely pattern that's centered on midnight. It kind of starts a few minutes before, 3 or 4 minutes, drops down and bottoms out around midnight, and then it comes back up and goes on being normal again.
Now, you've done a lot of New Year's Eves. Is that pattern there across from one year to the next?
Absolutely every year, except for those years when it's not. And there are some. This year, for example, has a marvelous peak, but it's the wrong direction.
I see.
So it dilutes the overall average, but the overall average is still significant. We make a prediction that it will decrease, and on average it has decreased to a significant degree, pretty much surrounding midnight, centered on midnight. That's a very nice thing, because what do I know? You know, I may even forget.
And you're not even the one defining New Year's midnight.
That's correct.
It happens whether you're doing it or not.
That's right. Yeah.
So that gets you off the hook.
I think. I mean, it's people who say, you know, or you know, worry about that sort of thing will still say, but in the data, which are very, very strong indications that it has to be something different from a single source.
Mm-hmm.
For example, large events are more powerful than small events. They produce bigger effects. And nobody's surprised about that. But then when we start looking at this separation between REGs and ask how big is the correlation as a function of the separation, well, it turns out that there is a small decrease in the correlation as distance increases, which goes against some of the beliefs that people have about psi research outcomes. We tend to think it's non-local, and it can't. You know, the distance doesn't matter. Well, it does matter in this case, but what we're looking at is a correlation between devices that are separated by certain large and small distances, and that decrease happens mainly in small events. Mm-hmm. What's a small event? That's one that's relatively local. Not so many people involved. So
The intensity? I mean, a local event may have some intense emotional aspect to the people in that area. I'm thinking of the George Washington Bridge in in Fort Lee.
Yeah, well.
Whereas the people in Japan probably couldn't care less, or the people, you know, in Fiji.
Right.
But on the other hand, there's going to be some real intense emotional feeling from all those people who were stuck in traffic.
Right. We didn't actually look at that as a global event.
Yeah.
But that would definitely be a small one. And if we had looked at it and there was any sort of effect, it would have been rather local, as
right.
you say.
So you'd expect to see it more in the New Jersey, New York.
That's right. So devices. The correlations between random number generators in, you know, around here. They would be larger.
So you really are faced with a problem of not only being able to work around distance and time, but you've also got subjective factors like the emotional intensity, mm-hmm. or the number of people, or the social, cultural venue of those people, mm-hmm. That might make it more meaningful or less meaningful. So you've got a multivariate problem, my friend.
Oh, we do. And if we only had a bunch of graduate students, they could sort all that stuff out. But we don't. So we make stabs at it. Two or three people have done categorization studies. We look through the events and we ask which ones are positive and which are negative. And then we ask, does this positivity or valence make any difference? And the answer is really not very much. Mm. It's a little surprising, but that's the answer we get. And what about big and small? I mentioned that. The big events get much bigger effects. The events which show strong emotions of the sort that bring people together, compassion being the prime example, they're almost definitionally an interconnection. You don't do compassion unless you've got somebody else. Yeah. So those produce larger effects in proportion to how much compassion we readers find in the events, and
now
so on.
You've done a number of measurements, if I could use that term, during global or large-scale meditation events, where people in vastly separated places are all meditating at the same time. Mm-hmm. How do those work out?
In a way, a little. It's surprising to me how strong they are.
Really?
They're actually fairly strong in spite of the fact that there is a subset which has a very frequent, almost always consistent, backwards going, negative going effect that subtracts from the bottom line if you're computing composite statistics. Mm. But they are so strong in their own right that they're significantly backwards. And by the way, we have analysis that and modeling that shows that there really are some events which produce the negative correlations, even though our prediction from the beginning has been we'll win if the measure goes high. If it goes low, sorry.
Does it matter?
Well,
a correlation is still a correlation.
Exactly. I mean, I think that's true, but I'm just in terms of our, you know, what we count as a win or count toward the confirmation of the hypothesis, anything that goes backwards, and the stronger it goes backwards, the worse for our hypothesis test.
Yeah.
But it turns out it doesn't matter so much. I'll just give some numbers. Almost exactly 2/3 of the events in the whole database have positive outcomes, and we're predicting, you know, if it was a 50-50 chance, that's a big, you know, that accounts for a lot of our cumulative total deviation. About 16 or 17% are null. There's no way that we can fit them, you know, call them anything different from zero. And then there's another 16 or 17% which are likely true negative outcomes. It's a very interesting fact that we didn't know, of course, at the beginning. Now we know. We could switch in our hypothesis and say, well, let's find some way of accommodating those. If we could only predict ahead of time which one's going to be negative, we would have more accumulated effect.
Are those 16% though characterized by certain types of events? More than others?
I think maybe the answer, I have to say I don't know for sure, but I don't think so. I think there are several powerful negative going effects for grand world's meditations, and including a couple from data during times when the transcendental meditation siddhis came together to sit in Washington, D.C. and other places like that. But to make the story, you know, not too long, I don't know for sure, but there some of those events are things that I would have... Here's one. Most of the time when we get a major natural disaster, we'll get a positive effect in the sense that it matches the prediction. the Haiti earthquake, which was such a huge disaster, 200,000 people or more, has a very powerful negative going trend. It's so strong that one would say, as you did before, does it matter that it happens to go backwards to your arbitrary prediction? It's really strong.
What about the tsunami in Japan?
The tsunami in Japan has a modest positive outcome. There is a strong, because...
That was an earthquake in the water.
And we didn't feel, nobody cared for a little while, for a couple of minutes
that's
or whatever.
That's so interesting.
It's hard to know how to think about, for those big ones, especially the ones that don't do what I sort of expect they might. I do a lot of extra analysis, or the group of us do, and in Japan, if I drew a picture of the data for about 3 or 4 days, it has a very, very strong downward trend until about the time of the earthquake, and then it comes back up to produce, and that was when our prediction was made, oh, the earthquake happened at this time, we'll look at the period following that. During that period, we had a positive trend, but it was on top of a very strong negative trend. Yeah. So there was a kind of V-shaped curve in the data where the earthquake is right at the bottom of the V before, who knows what was going on, and after, which, by the way, is the pattern we see in those 600 carefully analyzed earthquakes. Yeah.
You know, it reminds me of an event we had, you may recall, an operator at PEAR many years ago who was attempting to apply a certain healing technique while they were doing their experiments. And I think they had expected that when they would do this, they'd get a bigger effect. And they were rather surprised and I think disappointed when they discovered that not only did they get a bigger effect, but they got no effect. The output from the REG was quiet. There was less variability. And we talked about it afterwards. And I said, well, when you're doing this technique, what are you attempting to do? This person said, well, you want to create relaxation. You want the person to rest, to go into a very receptive mode. And I thought, well, you know, that's not too surprising then.
It's a nice description of the data.
And we saw that too in some of the field reg experiments, you may recall, when we would take the device into theatrical performances. Mm-hmm. I remember a couple of operas that we had attended. And you'd be sitting there during an absolutely spectacular performance. The entire audience is sitting on the edge of its chair, holding its breath. And you think, boy, that's got to do it. Nothing. But at the intermission, the thing goes wild. Like there's a release of this, you know, whatever. And that your description of the earthquake made me think of that. There is that release of this energy that's been building, and then whoosh.
There's some things like that in After Effects, things like... In Haiti, one of the analyses showed an enormous spike, almost, of deviation, something on the order of a day and a half, maybe as much as 2 days after. I don't remember the timing exactly, but it's as if we're all finally understanding how monstrous it is that there are actually 200,000 or 300,000 people killed in one swoop. Yeah. You know, these kinds of post hoc examinations they're good for creating new hypotheses, I guess, but not so good for evidence. Once we know those kind of things, it is possible to start doing some serious kinds of analysis. Yeah.
My sense over the many years we've been looking at this is that the old saying, the more you know, the more you don't know.
You're ruining my mind.
Every answer you get, you know, raises a dozen more questions.
Yeah.
And sometimes I wonder whether we're even supposed to get an answer or whether the point is in asking the question. This is supposed to stimulate us to start thinking about things that we don't usually think about. And does it matter if we have an absolute answer. Is there an answer?
Yeah. Now, I think there's a real possibility that we're destined, maybe as individuals, but maybe as a kind of scientific perspective, to go into a so what phase at somewhere. You know, all right, so we have some pretty interesting stuff, and we've got more questions than we know how to answer, and it's all very interesting, but then what? You know, what does it mean?
Well, if we knew everything, how dull the world would be. There'd be no need to go to school.
Well, I think we're in good shape.
I think we are too.
It's just amazing how what you said is exactly right. We really, really keep learning how little we know. We're looking at these things and gathering. I have something like 7 bits of information, and in the sense of my, in graduate school, I had an office mate and I, we rated the lectures we went to for the number of bits they produced. And we were always joyful if we could come out and say, that was a 2-bit lecture. And quite frequently, I mean, that's good, you know, you learn 2 things that are important that you didn't know before. So I think we have, you know, how many bits would there be?
Sometimes, like with the earthquake, you don't know they're important until years later.
So I think there's, you know, it's wonderful work, but it's not something we can finish, I think. We just keep on hoping that we get to the point where we can express something of value, I believe.
Well, you know, it's learning something of value, and it's asking questions about consciousness, or really asking questions about ourselves. Mm. Plato and all those wise people in the past used to say, know thyself.
Right.
I've often felt that the work we were doing, well, I won't even say it. We had an operator once, you may remember, who came out of the room after doing an experiment for a couple of hours and said, I don't know what I've done to your machine, but I've sure learned a lot about my ego.
Right, yep.
And these are experiments, all of this type of research are asking questions about ourselves, our minds, how we interact with the world, how we relate to the world. And that relationship between we as humans, and I'll limit it to humans, but not necessarily, and the environment around us, is really the stuff that of which reality is created. And we can't possibly understand reality if we only know one part or the other. It's like trying to understand love if you just know how one person feels and not the other.
Right? Oh, yeah. Well, that word is really created or creative. That's one of the bits. I think mm-hmm. one of the things that I'm personally feeling rather confident about is that we've shown in the laboratory, in the field experiments, in the Global Consciousness Project, that consciousness is not an idle artifact. Instead, it's a creative entity.
Yeah.
You know, it actually does things in the world, not by pushing the muscles around, but by actually changing something in the world.
It may very well be the creative force of the universe. I could ask you, you know, where you go from here, assuming that you even know where you're going from here. I don't know about you, but I don't.
Well, I mean, yes, I guess lunch. No, it's a good question, and I've been getting progressively longer in the tooth, as they say. And I think about, you know, should I just stop this 15-year-old project and go read good books? Or is there somebody that might want to pick up the email chains and keep it running and that sort of thing? But I think I won't be able to answer that until something changes.
Well,
too much fun to just stop.
As we all get a little longer in the tooth and get closer to the end of our mortal trips, we may be coming closer and closer to the question or the event that defines all of it.
Mm.
Is our consciousness just a process that our physical brains produce, or is it something vaster and more wondrous that is not limited? I don't know about other people, but I find it very reassuring to consider that there's more to me than my physical brain. It means that even when the physical body is gone, I can still ask dumb questions.
Well, I feel the same thing. And then there's another aspect, and I know you think about this too, that we know. I know in a deep way. And it's partly from, I guess, doing yoga and meditation or whatever when I was little, and partly from the data. It says, I'm not alone. I'm not stuck inside my skull. I'm interconnected. There are people all around me, and some I don't know, some I do, but it doesn't matter. There's a kind of a subtle web and network in which we're all participating. I was about to say enmeshed, but people get worried about things like that. No, there's a kind of beautiful understructure of interconnection that defines consciousness in a big sense. And we're, I think, looking at scientific evidence that that exists, and we have a chance through that to find out more about it and maybe even how to, you know, learn from it, take advantage of it.
We could even call it something like a global consciousness network.
I suppose we could.
Roger, I have always enjoyed our conversations, and as you know, we could go on for hours, but I think our time is up. I hope we'll have a chance to do this again. Thank you so much for spending your time and talking to our friends out there. I'm sure that there will be a lot of people with questions or comments, or I'd like to suggest that anybody who wants more information about the Global Consciousness Project can go to your website. What is the link?
Well, one of the simplest ways is to look for Global Consciousness Project in a browser. But there are two websites that I can give. One of them is global-mind.org. The other one is Noosphere, noosphere.princeton.edu. Either of those will get you to the same website, which, by the way, is new. We now have a new and beautifully functioning website. And I want to thank you for inviting me and giving me an opportunity to talk about, as it turns out, not so much the Global Consciousness Project, but about the wonderful things that people who, like us, are so fortunate to be doing. This business of studying what human consciousness is about.
What's real.
It's really wonderful.
Well, folks, thank you for listening. Feel free to either check into the Global Consciousness Project websites. If you want to contact, you can write to us at ICRL. We can pass your questions on to Roger. And Roger is typically much better than I am at answering promptly. And we're very glad that you've taken the time to join us today.